In these places of prayer that we're listening to Teresa talk about her experience of prayer, accompanying these states of prayer in her experience, we're going to see that it's not at all necessary, but in fact she did, she had certain what we'll call mystical graces, certain, let's say, extraordinary psychic spiritual experiences. So I'm going to look at three of them with you, three kinds of experience, and you'd be familiar with these, and then look at her and general judgment of how we might assess them, how we might know how to think about them. The first is words, hearing words in prayer that seem to come from God. In 1557, for the first time, she had such an experience. She believed it was Jesus speaking to her, and she, in her life, she quotes the words, the experience, I don't mean hearing with your ears, but hearing in your soul and sensing that someone's talking to you, and it's Jesus. He said, "No longer do I want you to converse with human beings, but with angels." On another occasion she heard, so she thought, "Do not fear, daughter, for I am and I will not abandon you. Do not fear." In her spiritual testimonies there are four words that she heard at different stages of her prayer life. And I'll give them to you just as they come. "Strive to have the right intention and to be detached in all things, and look at me," that's Jesus, "so that what you do may be in conformity with what I did." So she's praying in this communion with God, betrothal communion, and she hears this being spoken to her in her interior prayer. Another, "Give me your hands. Behold my wounds, you are not without me. This short life is passing away." Another example, "Do not try to hold me within yourself. Try to hold yourself within me." And finally, "Progress does not come by trying to enjoy me more," says Jesus to Teresa. "Progress doesn't come by trying to enjoy me more, but by trying to do my will." So now a comment. Teresa is aware of the danger of being deceived in this matter. And in her interior castle, she advises people who suffer with a flighty imagination to ignore such experiences. It is quite obvious from the experience, human experience, that people will claim to be hearing God telling them to do things, and when they actually do them, it's quite berserk, it's quite off balance, it's quite out of touch with tradition, it's got nothing to do with Jesus. And yet they'll be sure God said it, and they'll do it to their own harm and everyone else around them. So we're clearly dealing with a very subtle psychic phenomena. Some of it can be beautifully graced, some of it can be from a psyche that is not at all healthy. So she warns people who tend to be hysterical or to leave all this alone and just relax and just behave themselves. Not to ignore such things. Now, more importantly, no one should take notice of such, inverted commas, words before seeking the guidance of a spiritual director. That's her, everyone says that. Don't presume that it's from God on your own. Seek a wise person whom you trust, who won't flatter you or deceive you. And share it and check it. For 2 years, this was her experience, she tells us in her life, for 2 years after the first time she heard words, which we've just quoted, her confessors, the spiritual directors, told her to treat the words as a temptation. So they were following the standard, wise, normal advice to be given. She did her best to obey them, because she knew also, and this is another general principle of spiritual life, Jesus often says in these visions and whatever to people, look, take it to your spiritual director. If your spiritual director disagrees with me, Jesus is saying, obey your spiritual director, not me. He knows that obedience is so important and humility is so important, and if God wants something done, it will happen. Jesus will persist. So really the weight of advice is on the side of humility, obedience and normalcy. So she did her best to obey her confessors, knowing that God wanted her to obey them even when they were wrong. In this case, they were actually wrong. These words were from Jesus. She's confident that if these experiences are from God, and this is another criterion of testing them, they will produce profound peace in the soul, not excitement or certainly not pride, certainly not self-focus, certainly not unable to get up and share it feeling. No, a gentle, peaceful, humble, lowly, loving attitude of humility and thanking and praising God. And she also says in the interior castle, this is another criterion that is key, if these words are in fact from God, whether they're your own, for you've experienced, or other people, then they will draw the person into a deeper obedience. So these simple obedience, humility, peace, are lovely, at least careful criteria to check. So if a person is using these experiences to draw attention to themselves, then we know it's not from God, so we just ignore it. So that's words claiming to come from God. Second mystical experience which Teresa had and other people have are what we call ecstasies or raptures. I'll just talk about that for a moment. I'll just read, these are all quotations from Teresa, different, her interior castle and her spiritual testimony. And she writes, God concludes the betrothal, which she's talked about, by giving the soul a rapture, an ecstasy, which draws it away from the senses. In a rapture, an ecstasy, God carries off for himself the entire soul. The difference between rapture and union is this, she says. The rapture lasts longer and is felt more exteriorly. The soul is so occupied with rejoicing with what the Lord represents to it that it seemingly, the soul, forgets to animate the body and leaves the body abandoned. These are all her words to try to, you know what we're talking about, but just to remind you of it. In this rapture, she says, the soul seems no longer to animate the body, and resistance is impossible. However, there's no loss of consciousness. On the contrary, the soul has never before been so fully awake to the things of God. Father Marie Eugène, in his book, I Am a Daughter of the Church, expose of Teresa's teaching, has this to say: these espousals, this prayer of betrothal, which we've talked about, take place in a rapture, he says, in an encounter in the light, and are sometimes accompanied by transports of the soul, flights of spirit which show the weakness of the body and the irresistible force of the one whom Teresa calls the powerful giant. Now there's a key word in there. Shows the weakness of the body. Ecstasy, which you know what it is, where a person is spiritually entirely conscious but unaware of what's going on around them, their senses and their bodies they're wrapped in some state that can't be disturbed. There are some people who, what the key to all that is the power of the spiritual union. The prayer is the key. That's what it's all about. Some people could have exactly the same intensity of prayer and not go into ecstasy. Some people with that prayer go into ecstasy. The difference is the strength of their psyche and their general constitution, and it is a weakness to have an ecstasy. That's a key thing to say. Now, nothing wrong with being weak when you have this enormously profound experience of God's love. But it is a weakness. It's nothing to be proud of and nothing to point to. And in itself, it is not a grace. The grace is the love prayer which the person is experiencing. The ecstasy is the inability of the psyche and the body of this person to hold it while they're retaining normal consciousness. To continue, and these are all statements of Teresa from the Interior Castle, she says, it will happen that even though the extreme ecstasy ends, the will remains so absorbed and the intellect so withdrawn for a day or even days that the latter seems incapable of understanding anything that doesn't lead to awakening the will to love. They're in another place. And they can't get back in touch. And the will is wide awake to this love and asleep to becoming attached to any creature. Teresa speaks of being suddenly caught up in love. In these sudden, what she calls, flights of the spirit, the soul sees itself and learns things that cannot be expressed and experiences overwhelming joy and delight. She says, since the soul goes about with such tender love, any occasion that enkindles the fire more causes the soul to fly aloft. Even though it is true that these are blessings which the Lord gives to whomever he wills, he would give them all to us if we loved him as he loves us, she says. We'll come back on all this at the end. Now, just the third and final experience, which I'm just touching on, is words, yes, ecstasy. Now, visions, and I don't mean a vision, an intellectual vision, like where you want to go, but an image, an apparition. Medjugorje, they're talking about it in A Lady to the lovely Bernadette at Lourdes, had this vision of a woman in the tree, and so often many people are visionaries, meaning they have this, and many of them are false too, but many of them have a genuine, intense experience of prayer which involves also what appears to be an apparition of Jesus or Mary or whoever, Jesus and Mary usually. So let's look at that for a while and see what Teresa might say about that, and then I'll come back with a general comment on the whole area. So under this general topic, but before we talk about actual apparitions or experiences that seem to be imaginary, visual, without any image, Teresa became, she tells us, deeply aware of Jesus being by her side. She didn't actually see him there, but she knew he was by her side very deeply. The result of this experience, which she talks about in her life and also in Interior Castle, made her even more acutely aware of the slightest movements of sin. She was very conscious of being in his presence, with him, with her. So the slightest sin offended her, sensitized her. It also made her more determined to give herself to him in love and to be available for anything he wanted her to do. She says, any fault which the soul commits pierces the soul to the very core of its being, and rightly so. So incredibly sensitive, as you are, if you really love someone, well then hurting them becomes all the more hurting because you've hurt someone you love. So she's very tenderly sensitive to the slightest movement that could dim the communion. She writes also, the soul experiences peace and continually desires to please God. To surrender oneself totally to his service and to give a greater purity of conscience because of his presence by one's side makes the soul attentive to everything. Also, now another experience she talks about in her spiritual testimonies is, and she names the date, on the 30th of June, 1571, she had an extraordinarily profound experience of the Blessed Trinity dwelling in her soul. And it remained with her from then on. Sense of the Father loving the Son in her, and the Son loving the Father in her, and the spirit of communion all happening in the temple of her body. And she kind of knew it, and it never... I mean, there was darkness, but this truth never left her. She writes, the thought came to me of how a sponge absorbs and is saturated with water. So, I thought, was my soul, which was overflowing with the divinity, and in a certain way rejoicing within itself and possessing in itself the three persons. And now more strictly, visions, apparitions. Sometimes an image of Jesus was part of her experience during such moments of intimacy. And this happened, she names it, the first time it happened to her, she tells us in her life, was on January the 25th in 1561. She actually, let me say, saw Jesus. In her life, she records other images which came to her in prayer. On one occasion, she had an image of an angel who pierced her in the depths of her heart. On May the 29th in 1563, she had a vision of a dove while she was reading the life of Christ by Ludolf of Saxony, the Carthusian. And in the middle of her reading, she had an image, I'll say, she uses, of a dove. She tells us how she saw Jesus being taken into the bosom of the Trinity. These were, she says in her Interior Castle, very different kinds of images from any that we might produce from our own imagination. So, what's happening here? Now I leave Teresa for a while, if I may, and I'll tentatively just share with you whatever reflections I have on this, without giving them any value. We're not talking about seeing. I don't think we're talking about the eye actually seeing an object. Because, in a sense, there isn't a physical object present to be seen. If Bernadette sees Mary at Lourdes, why is it that Mary looks like the statue in the local church? If if it's Mary or Jesus that these various people are seeing, why is it that the Jesus they see is the one they imagine, the Sacred Heart, as they imagine it from a picture or something? Could we conclude from these visionaries that since this is the object they're seeing, it's Jesus, the risen Jesus speaking to them, and he's often got quite pale skin, because that's what the holy pictures have, whereas Jesus actually would have been much more, living in the Middle East, he would have had more olive, dark skin. Secondly, does the risen body have a face like this? Does the risen body have arms and legs and a body shaped like ours? Do we know that? No. By risen body we mean the whole human being, feelings, thoughts, images, memories, loves, is all raised up, but in a way we cannot possibly imagine, and it transcends any of our images. When Paul, in the first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 15, talks about the resurrection, he asks halfway through the chapter, what kind of a body do we have when we rise? And then he immediately says, that's a foolish question, and talks about the bodies of the spiritual bodies, other bodies, the stars. He talks about, in other words, no, we can't even imagine the risen body, risen beauty in the. And then he goes on to fumblingly try to just talk about it. But so we're like a lot of little caterpillars arguing about what we'll be like when we come out of the chrysalis. And none of us imagine we'll be a butterfly, because we haven't got wings. But they do have wings, and they, when they look at a butterfly, they probably don't know that's me, because it looks like a different thing. So we don't know the reason. No, none of that is factually knowledge. So come back to my point, and I'm only tentatively sharing it with you. I'm suggesting that I don't imagine that we're actually seeing an object. Could it be that what's happening is that the person is so profoundly moved by a real experience of communion, that I'm not doubting, that it is Mary speaking to Bernadette, it is Jesus speaking to Margaret Mary, or whatever, and the church, unless the church has looked into it really carefully, we do better to ignore all this and wait for that to happen. But let's take it, these ones where the church has looked at it and looked at it and looked at it, and by all the criteria says, yes, this was a genuine experience that we can listen to. Now, if that's happened, which makes us have some interest, that we still don't need to take any notice of it. You don't have to take any notice of private revelation ever. It's not part of our faith. But it may help. So if we're listening to that, then could it be that Bernadette, having this real experience of Mary, is so profoundly moved in her soul that she projects an image? It's an imaginary image. It's like a dream. It is a projection of her psyche. So she imagines it. It's so real to her. She sees it in her image, in imagination, as though it were real. And that's something to do with the psyche of the girl and her psychological makeup and all that kind of thing, and part of the providence of God. I don't know, but I suggest that I wonder if that's what it might be. Wanting only what God wants is the key. Working at perfect conformity to God's will, expressed through love of our neighbour. It brings up the very important point. We mustn't look at Teresa's teaching, or John of the Cross, or actually anyone on this. Don't see it as a progression, as though you're climbing up a ladder, so that you leave vocal prayer behind, and then you go into meditation, then you leave that behind, then you go into prayer of quiet, then you leave that behind, then you go. It's not this. My image for it is much more like an unfolding of a rose or a flower of some kind. where the flower is all there, but when it's closed in, it's only open a little bit to the light and sun. But as the petals unfold, more possibilities of letting nature in are there. So as we progress in prayer, we keep all we've had before, but we open up to wider, deeper, more mysterious possibilities of encounter with God and of love. Therefore, also, we don't withdraw. It's not a withdrawal from the world experience. The fruit of this is going to be, for most people, a much more active involvement in the world, because if we're close to God and God wants to love the world, we'll want to love the world. So it'll be a sense of mission and love. She does say somewhere, well, of course we can't organise this prayer, that's by definition, but there is something we can do to dispose ourselves to it, and she says that's love. And as far as I understand, primarily she means loving one another. Love one another as I have loved you. This union of the whole soul, we're talking about the prayer of union, and that's what distinguishes it. It's the union of the whole of our psyche. Psyche is the Greek word that we translate soul. The whole of our psyche is something, she says a number of times, that it passes quickly. She's talking about something that might only last a minute or what, who knows, it's timeless, but it's brief. This communion and union that's so complete. And it does cause pain. The pain of longing, as with any of us. All the songs are about this, the chagrin d'amour dure toute la vie. The joy of love lasts a moment, but the pain of love lasts all life. So it's, but one wouldn't want to be without it. To not be loved is one thing. To be loved and be unsatisfied in love, unrequited love perhaps, it's still love. So the pain is something that we would want. And so we want this, even though it touches the soul briefly and leads to a desire for much more. It is that kind of pain. Now, that's offering you Teresa's description of the experience. Now she, and others would agree with her, give us four ways of not assessing it, but four criteria for testing it, or four fruits of such prayer that show that it's real, because we might wonder. The first, and she says, it's a sure sign that one is in this prayer of union, is, quoting, when the soul returns to itself, it can in no way doubt that it was in God and that God was in it. Our soul is made for God. We are made for God. And we know when we're at home. And the soul knows that this is God. However, it's only the springtime of a union. There's a lot of journeying still to do. We'll be looking at it today and for the next 2 weeks. There's a lot of purifying to be done, but a communion of love has been established at a very deep level of the soul. The second fruit of this prayer, or criterion for assessing its reality, is what she calls perfect attachment and obedience. Perfect is the key word there. We did a week on detachment earlier in the course. We did a week on obedience, so I'll take that as done. But now it's perfect. It's detachment, as you know, means loving in such a way that we're willing to let anything go if love calls us to do so. So it's holding everything with open hands. It's not possessing, not using, anything like that. It's a love that is perfect, pure, but it's holding those we love gently and willing to let go anything or anyone if, that's a critical word, if love calls us. Like Peter, we're willing to step out of the boat and walk across the water if we're called. Well, that's detachment. Obedience is a constant listening. A listening and recognizing, like the sheep recognize, hear the voice of the shepherd. So a wanting to hear, a readiness to hear, an open, alert, attentive heart that's ready. And when we hear, we want to do it because God wants it. So there, if they're happening in our life, in out of this prayer of union, that's the second way of knowing that it's from God. God draws us into a state of detachment and obedience. He invites us to comply faithfully to his action as he frees us from the last remaining bonds that fetter us, hindering our flight to God. That image reminds me of John of the Cross, who talks about a little bird wanting to fly, but it's attached, one of its legs is attached to something, tied to something. Now it can be tied by a very thick piece of string that stops it flying. But it can actually be tied also by a tiny little gossamer thread of silk. So John of the Cross's point is we have to break all attachments. Any attachment stops us flying. You can break a lot, but if there's still some holding you, you can't fly. In this state of prayer, through this union of the whole soul which God grants us, attachments are gone. Let me quote Teresa from her interior castle. Everything we see on earth leaves us dissatisfied, especially when God has again and again given us this wine, which almost every time has brought us a new blessing, these moments of union that we're talking about. We are no longer bound by ties of relationship, friendship, or property. Previously, all our acts of will and resolutions and desires were powerless to loosen them and seemed only to bind them the more firmly. Now, we are grieved at having even to fulfill our obligations. In these respects, less they should cause us to sin against God. Everything wearies us because we've discovered that we can find no rest in creatures. Continuing, and all of these are from her interior castle, just to give a feel for what she says. Teresa, we've now surrendered ourselves into God's hands, and God's great love has so completely subdued us that we neither know nor desire anything save that God shall do with us what he wills. Now, if this isn't your experience, and if it isn't my experience, all we're saying is this is Teresa's experience, and it might give us a taste of what God would like to offer us. She goes on, I consider it better to place ourselves in the presence of the Lord and look at his mercy and grandeur and at our own lowliness and let God give us what he wants, whether water or dryness. He knows best what is suitable for us. With such an attitude, we can go about refreshed. As they say, then it doesn't matter if someone gives you honour or dishonour. If someone says the truth about you or a lie about you. Whatever they're doing, reputation good or bad, these things, so they're telling us, cannot touch, well, they hurt, but don't affect the way a person behaves. We're much more detached from creatures because we now see that only the Creator can console and satisfy us. The third sign that she gives of this prayer of union is the gift of a profound love for God. It's obvious. The yearning for God himself, says Father Marie-Eugène, the yearning for God himself beyond all his gifts, his lights and his raptures, forms the dynamism of this period. And now, finally, and maybe even surprisingly, but very importantly, a a sign of the trueness of the prayer of union, I've mentioned it before, but here it is in detail, is a profound love for other people and a zeal for mission. A zeal to draw others into the same communion with God. A new zeal to be active in the mission of the church, which is, in Paul's words, the fullness of him who fills the whole of creation. His body which builds itself up in love. Christ loved the church, says Paul, and gave himself for her. So there's a new zeal to build the kingdom of God on earth. To share his love and his willingness to offer himself in our love for others. Family, children, life, whatever we are. Perish. Suffering at seeing others offending God and a desire to suffer with Jesus for their redemption. As Teresa says, having now a clear realization that the fruits of this prayer are not our own, we can start to share them and yet have no lack of them. Because through detachment and obedience, the person has in fact gone beyond there being a problem. He or she knows that her gifts, his gifts, are not hers or his. They come from God, and therefore he can freely give them without distraction. Teresa again, the surest sign that we are keeping the two commandments of love is that we're really loving our neighbour. That's standard Christian teaching. Be certain that the farther advanced you find yourself in this love of neighbour, the greater is your love for God. Love, says Father Marie Eugène, commenting on Teresa's teaching, love makes perfect apostles, for love alone can form worthy instruments of God, and only love's flame makes apostolic activity fruitful. Finally, a comment. How is one gifted with this prayer? This prayer of union of the whole soul, momentary though it be. How does one receive it? Teresa suggests two ways. She talks about how she received it, and it was in quite a distinct moment of mystical experience. But she's very clear on the fact that everyone will experience it differently. And not everyone has to receive it the way she did. Here's her own account in Interior Castle. For the short time that the condition lasts, the soul is without consciousness and has no power to think, even though it may desire to do so. In fact, the soul has completely died to the world so that it may live more fully in God. This is a delightful death, a snatching of the soul from all the activities which it can perform while it's in the body. That's how she received it. Like she could point to the day, the moment, the ecstasy of it. However, others, it's the fruit of a slow progress, a faithful asceticism. It's a bit like conversion. You probably know some people, didn't read in the media, it's a very obvious thing. Some people go through, and you may have done it yourself, a conversion that you can name, you know, it happened here, or it happened there, or happened when Billy Graham came, or it happened when whatever else happened. A moment of or experience of one's life where, yes, you can name that day where there was almost a flip coin or a real change in your life. A moment of conversion that everything after it's different and everything before is something else. But that's never happened to me, and maybe it's never happened to you. For some people, it's just a gradual maturing into love, I suppose, depending on where you've been and what's happened. And all that's important is that we don't expect anyone else to have the experiences we had, and we mustn't ever want to inflict our experiences on other people. We just want to draw them to God, in God's way and their way. So it's very sacred ground and very personal. Teresa says, in many ways, and bring souls and bring them to these mansions by many other paths, than the shortcut which has just been described. For her, it was a shortcut in the providence of God, but for you it may not be. That concludes the first part of this first half, where I'm wanting to talk about the prayer of union, just to show you what happened to Teresa. Before I move on to the next experience that she talks about, I just finished reading last week when I was away giving a retreat to some saintly elderly sisters in Melbourne, a book. I took a few books with me and I had time in the plane. Now, there's a book by John Climacus written in the middle of the 7th century or a bit earlier. Climacus is the Greek word for ladder. So all we really know is his name was John. I'll tell you a little bit about him. He, at the age of 16, he went into Egypt and became a hermit. And for 40 years he lived the hermit solitary life in the desert area some 40 kilometres from Mount Sinai. Such was his clear grace and extraordinary quality of life that he was taken to the monastery and made the abbot of the rather large monastery on Mount Sinai. And while he was there, he was asked by another monastery to write. So he wrote this book called The Ladder of Divine Ascent, but it has 30 steps in this ladder. It's an amazingly interesting book. It's a classical book in the Eastern Church. And in that Eastern monastic way, it's one of their obligatory texts, you might say. Now, in it, among other things, he has some things to say about contemplation. I thought they were rather lovely. This is not in your notes, but I've got it here for you to just glean. He says, "Don't hurry to contemplation at the wrong time. Rather, let it come to you." But by definition, that's essential. Let it come to you. Seeking out the beauty of your lowliness, humility, ready to join you for a long time in a spotless marriage. Elsewhere he writes, "When you have found the Lord, you no longer have to use words when you're praying." And he quotes from Romans chapter 8, "For the Spirit will intercede for you with groans that cannot be expressed in words." And then he says something which has helped me in the way I presented this tonight. "You can't learn to see just because someone tells you to do so. To see, you need your own natural power of sight. In the same way, you cannot discover from the teaching of others the beauty of prayer. Prayer has its own special teacher in God, who grants the prayer to the person who prays. No one can teach you how to love. No one can teach you how to pray." That doesn't mean that we can't learn from others, as long as we don't copy them or expect what happened to them to happen to us. But the wisdom of someone like Teresa or John of the Cross, who are acknowledged in the church to be very wise guides and who have guided many people who've been grateful and become saints, indicates that as long as we're talking about God and not Teresa or John of the Cross, they can guide us and help us at times when we need knowledge to help us over something that might become a barrier otherwise.